Chapter 22. Yourself, you know you will. So you may take her or leave her, as you think fit. Let her sing one night as a trial, said Mr. Slang. If she sings one night, the creditors will want their money in full, replied the captain. Shan't let her labor, poor thing, for the profit of those scoundrels, added the prisoner, with much feeling. And Slang left him with a much greater respect for Walker than he had ever before possessed. He was struck with the gallantry of the man who could triumph over misfortunes, nay, make misfortune itself an engine of good luck. Mrs. Walker was instructed instantly to have a severe sore throat. The journals in Mr. Slang's interest deplored this illness pathetically, while the papers in the interest of the opposition theater magnified it with great malice. He knew Singer, said one, the great wonder which Slang promised us, is as hoarse as a raven. Dr. Thorax pronounces, wrote another paper, that the Quincy, which has suddenly prostrated Mrs. Ravenswing, whose singing at the Philharmonic, previous to her appearance at the T.R.R. apostrophe excited so much applause, has destroyed the lady's voice forever. We luckily need no other prima donna, when that place, as nightly thousands acknowledge, is held by Miss Ligonier. The looker-on said, that although some well-informed contemporaries had declared Mrs. W. Ravenswing's complaint to be a Quincy, others, on whose authority they could equally rely, had pronounced it to be a consumption. At all events, she was in an exceedingly dangerous state, from which, though we do not expect, we heartily trust she may recover. Opinions differ as to the merits of this lady, some saying that she was altogether inferior to Miss Ligonier, while other connoisseurs declare the latter lady to be by no means so accomplished a person. This point, we fear, continued the looker-on, can never now be settled, unless, which we fear is improbable, Mrs. Ravenswing should ever so far recover as to be able to make her debut, and even then, the new singer will not have a fair chance, unless her voice and strength shall be fully restored. This information, which we have from exclusive resources, may be relied on, concluded the looker-on, as authentic. It was Mr. Walker himself, that artful and audacious Fleet prisoner, who concocted those very paragraphs against his wife's health which appeared in the journals of the Ligonier party. The partisans of that lady were delighted, the creditors of Mr. Walker astounded, at reading them. Even Sir George Thrum was taken in, and came to the Fleet prison in considerable alarm. "Mum's the word, my good sir," said Mr. Walker. "How's the time to make arrangements with the creditors?" Well, these arrangements were finally made. It does not matter how many shillings in the pound satisfied the rapacious creditors of Morgina's husband, but it is certain that her voice returned to her all of a sudden upon the captain's release. The papers of the Mulligan faction again trumpeted her perfections. The agreement with Mr. Slang was concluded, that with Sir George Thrum the great composer satisfactorily arranged, and the new opera underlined in immense capitals in the bills, and put in rehearsal with immense expenditure on the part of the scene painter and costumier. Need we tell with what triumphant success the Brigand's Bride was received? All the Irish sub-editors the next morning took care to have such an account of it as made Miss Ligonier and Barisky die with envy. All the reporters who could spare time were in the boxes to support their friend's work. All the journeymen tailors of the establishment of Lindsay, Woolsey, and Company had pit tickets given to them, and applauded with all their might. All Mr. Walker's friends of the Egent Club lined the side boxes with white kid gloves, and in a little box by themselves sat Mrs. Crump and Mr. Woolsey, a great deal too much agitated to applaud, so agitated that Woolsey even forgot to fling down the bouquet he had brought for the Ravenswing. But there was no lack of those horticultural ornaments. The theater servants wheeled away a wheelbarrow full which were flung on the stage the next night over again, and Morgina, blushing, panting, weeping, was led off by Mr. Poppleton, the eminent tenor, who had crowned her with one of the most conspicuous of the chaplets. He or she flew to her husband and flung her arms round his neck. He was flirting behind the side scenes with Mademoiselle Flick Flack, who had been dancing in the divertissement, and was probably the only man in the theater of those who witnessed the embrace that did not care for it. Even Slang was affected, and said with perfect sincerity that he wished he had been in Walker's place. The manager's fortune was made, at least for the season. He acknowledged so much to Walker, who took a week's salary for his wife in advance that very night. There was, as usual, a grand supper in the green room. The terrible Mr. Bluthier appeared in a new coat of the well-known woolsey cut, and the little tailor himself and Mrs. Crump were not the least happy of the party. But when the Ravenswing took Woolsey's hand, and said she never would have been there but for him, Mr. Walker looked very grave, and hinted to her that she must not, in her position, encourage the attentions of persons in that rank of life. "I shall pay," said he, proudly, "every farthing that is owing to Mr. Woolsey, and shall employ him for the future. But you understand, my love, that one cannot at one's own table receive one's own tailor." Slang proposed Morgina's health in a tremendous speech, which elicited cheers, and laughter, and sobs, such as only managers have the art of drawing from the theatrical gentlemen and ladies in their employ. It was observed, especially among the chorus singers at the bottom of the table, that their emotion was intense. They had a meeting the next day, and voted a piece of plate to Adolphus Slang Esquire, for his eminent services in the cause of the drama. Walker returned thanks for his lady. That was, he said, the proudest moment of his life. He was proud to think that he had educated her for the stage, happy to think that his sufferings had not been in vain, and that his exertions in her behalf were crowned with full success. In her name and his own, he thanked the company, and sat down, and was once more particularly attentive to Mademoiselle Flick Flack. Then came an oration from Sir George Thrum, in reply to Slang's toast to him. It was very much to the same effect as the speech by Walker, the two gentlemen attributing to themselves individually the merit of bringing out Mrs. Walker. He concluded by stating that he should always hold Mrs. Walker as the daughter of his heart, and to the last moment of his life, should love and cherish her. It is certain that Sir George was exceedingly elated that night, and would have been scolded by his lady on his return home, but for the triumph of the evening. Mulligan's speech of thanks, as author of The Brigand's Bride, was, it must be confessed, extremely tedious. It seemed there would be no end to it, when he got upon the subject of Ireland especially, which somehow was found to be intimately connected with the interests of music and the theater. Even the choristers pooh-poohed this speech, coming though it did from the successful author, whose songs of wine, love, and battle, they had been repeating that night. The Brigand's Bride ran for many nights. Its choruses were tuned on the organs of the day. Morgina's airs, "The Rose Upon My Balcony" and "The Lightning on the Cataract" recitative and scene, were on everybody's lips, and brought so many guineas to Sir George Thrum, that he was encouraged to have his portrait engraved, which still may be seen in the music shops. Not many persons, I believe, bought proof impressions of the plate, price 2 guineas, whereas, on the contrary, all the young clerks in banks, and all the fast young men of the universities, had pictures of the Ravenswing in their apartments as Biondetta the Brigand's Bride, as Zulema in the Uptiles of Benners, as Barbaresca in the Ine of Tobolsk, and in all her famous characters. In the latter she disguises herself as Aeolin, in order to save her father, who is in prison, and the Ravenswing looked so fascinating in this costume in pantaloons and yellow boots, that Slang was for having her instantly in Captain Macheath, whence arose their quarrel. She was replaced at Slang's theater by Snooks, the rhinoceros tamer, with his breed of wild buffaloes. Their success was immense. Slang gave a supper, at which all the company burst into tears, and assembling in the green room next day, they, as usual, voted a piece of plate to Adolphus Slang Esquire, for his eminent services to the drama. In the Captain Mackey's dispute, Mr. Walker would have had his wife yield, but on this point, and for once, she disobeyed her husband and left the theater. And when Walker cursed her according to his wont for her abominable selfishness and disregard of his property, she burst into tears and said as he had spent but 20 guineas on herself and baby during the year, that her theatrical dressmaker's bills were yet unpaid, and that as he had never asked him how much he spent on that odious French figurant. All this was true, except about the French figurant. Walker, as the lord and master, received all Morgina's earnings, and spent them as a gentleman should. He gave very neat dinners at a cottage in Regent's Park. Mr. and Mrs. Walker lived at Green Street, Grosvenor Square. He played a good deal at the Egent. But as to the French figurant, it must be confessed that Mrs. Walker was in a sad error. That lady and the captain had parted long ago. It was Madame Dolores de Trazomontes who inhabited the cottage in St. John's Wood now. But if some little errors of this kind might be attributable to the captain, on the other hand, when his wife was in the provinces, he was the most attentive of husbands, made all her bargains, and received every shilling before he would permit her to sing a note. Thus he prevented her from being cheated, as a person of her easy temper doubtless would have been, by designing managers and needy concert givers. They always traveled with 4 horses, and Walker was adored in every one of the principal hotels in England. The waiters flew at his bell. The chambermaids were afraid he was a sad, naughty man, and thought his wife no such great beauty. The landlords preferred him to any duke. He never looked at their bills, not he. In fact, his income was at least 4,000 a year for some years of his life. Master Wolsey Walker was put to Dr. Wapshot's seminary, whence, after many disputes on the doctor's part, as to getting his half-year's accounts paid, and after much complaint of ill treatment on the little boy's side, he was withdrawn, and placed under the care of the Reverend Mr. Swishtail, at Turnham Green, where all his bills are paid by his godfather, now the head of the firm of Wolsey and Company. As a gentleman, Mr. Walker still declines to see him, but he has not, as far as I have heard, paid the sums of money which he threatened to refund, and, as he is seldom at home, the worthy tailor can come to Green Street at his leisure. He and Mrs. Crump and Mrs. Walker often take the omnibus to Brentford, and a cake with them to little Wolsey at school, to whom the tailor says he will leave every shilling of his property. The Walkers have no other children, but when she takes her airing in the park, she always turns away at the sight of a loaf-eaten, in which sits a woman with rouged cheeks, and a great number of overdressed children, and a French bonne, whose name, I am given to understand, is Madame Dolores de Trazomontes. Madame de Trazomontes always puts a great gold glass to her eye as the Raven Swing's carriage passes, and looks into it with a sneer. The two coachmen used always to exchange queer winks at each other in the ring, until Madame de Trazomontes lately adopted a tremendous chasseur, with huge whiskers and a green and gold livery, since which time the formerly named gentlemen do not recognize each other. The Raven Swing's life is one of perpetual triumph on the stage, and, as every one of the fashionable men about town have been in love with her, you may fancy what a pretty character as he has. Lady Thrum would die sooner than speak to that unhappy young woman, and, in fact, the Thrums have a new pupil, who is a siren without the dangerous qualities of one, who has the person of Venus, and the mind of a muse, and who is coming out at one of the theaters immediately. Bereskai says, the little Raffenschwing is just as fond of me as ever. People are very shy about receiving her in society, and when she goes to sing at a concert, Miss Prim starts up and scurries off in a state of the greatest alarm, lest that person should speak to her. Walker is voted a good, easy, rattling, gentlemanly fellow, and nobody's enemy but his own. His wife, they say, is dreadfully extravagant. And, indeed, since his marriage, and in spite of his wife's large income, he has been in the bench several times, But she signs some bills, and he comes out again, and is as gay and genial as ever. All mercantile speculations he has wisely long since given up. He likes to throw a main of an evening, as I have said, and to take his couple of bottles at dinner. On Friday he attends at the theater for his wife's salary, and transacts no other business during the week. He grows exceedingly stout, dyes his hair, and has a bloated purple look about the nose and cheeks, very different from that which first charmed the heart of Morgiana. By the way, Eglanton has been turned out of the Bower of Bloom, and now keeps a shop at Tunbridge Wells. Going down thither last year without a razor, I asked a fat seedy man lolling in a faded nankeen jacket at the door of a tawdry little shop in the Pantles, to shave me. He said in reply, "Sir, I do not practice in that branch of the profession," and turned back into the little shop. It was Archibald Eglanton. But in the wreck of his fortunes he still has his captain's uniform, and his grand cross of the Order of the Castle and Falcon of Panama. Asterisk, 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 postscript. G. Fitzpoodle Esquire, 2O. York Esquire, Zum Triarishan Op, Coblins. July 10, 1843. My dear York, the story of the Raven Swing was written a long time since, and I never could account for the bad taste of the publishers of the metropolis who refused it an insertion in their various magazines. This fact would never have been alluded to, but for the following circumstance. Only yesterday, as I was dining at this excellent hotel, I remarked a bald-headed gentleman in a blue coat and brass buttons, who looked like a colonel on half pay, and by his side a lady, and a little boy of 12, whom the gentleman was cramming with an amazing quantity of cherries and cakes. A stout old dame in a wonderful cap and ribbons was seated by the lady's side, and it was easy to see they were English, and I thought I had already made their acquaintance elsewhere. The younger of the ladies at last made a bow with an accompanying blush. "Surely," said I have the honor of speaking to Mrs. Ravenswing?" "Mrs. Woolsey, sir," said the gentleman, "my wife has long since left the stage." And at this the old lady in the wonderful cap trod on my toes very severely, and nodded her head and all her ribbons in a most mysterious way. Presently the two ladies rose and left the table, the elder declaring that she heard the baby crying. "Woolsey, my dear, go with your mama," said Mr. Woolsey, patting the boy on the head. The young gentleman obeyed the command, carrying off a plate of macaroons with him. "Your son is a fine boy, sir," said I. "My stepson, sir," answered Mr. Woolsey, and added, in a louder voice, "I knew you, Mr. Fitzpoodle, at once, but did not mention your name for fear of agitating my wife. She don't like to have the memory of old times renewed, sir, her former husband, whom you know." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.